Hello. Welcome to the intimate and interactive Ajax Kung Fu meets accessibility feng shui. I didn't realize the lights were going to be this low, but I think I'll keep my voice like this for the whole time. Yeah. Good morning, everybody. A lot of empty seats. Must have been a big party night last night. Everybody here reasonable, or are you still hungover? Do we need to get some water passed out to the audience, or are we going to be all right? One thing to note, if you've been following the South by Southwest calendar, we are Ajax Kung Fu meets accessibility feng shui, but I do need to point out that I do not work for Pronson Records. This actually happened to me when I checked in. They gave me my badge. They said, you know, you're Derek Featherstone. Yes, this is me. But there's this other picture on your profile. Did you want to replace that? I guess because it didn't look like me. I thought it was from a previous year. So I get my badge, and it's Derek Featherstone of Pronsong Records, who's here apparently as a panelist for the music festival. This has never, ever happened to me before. I didn't know what to do, but I really want to meet the guy. So if anybody goes to the music part and they find him, please, please, please tell him to come and find me, or hold him down so that I can come and find him or something. So this is definitely not me, Pronsong Studios. Definitely not. We're going to keep things really quick, short and brief today. I know Jeremy and I both talked about this beforehand, and we very much enjoy the interactive setting, and we encourage and want a lot of Q&A. So we're going to try to keep ourselves to 15 minutes each, maybe 20 minutes, and then really open up the floor. Because I know this happened. We did a refresh thing on Friday night, and there's a lot of really good questions that came out of the audience, and I would hope that there's some good questions here too. So we're going to try and keep it brief. And with that, I will turn it over to Jeremy for his Ajax Kung Fu.
All right. Thank you very much, Derek. And thank you all for coming. So I'll do the Kung Fu. Derek will do the Feng Shui. So I'm doing the sexy stuff because Kung Fu is cool. And of course, I'm completely pandering to the crowd by having screenshots from The Matrix. I mean, it's a geek audience, right? I can't go wrong. So Ajax Kung Fu. We're going to be talking about accessibility in Ajax. And in a way, I'm going to be talking about accessibility now, but it's a certain kind of accessibility. There's two ways of looking at accessibility. Accessibility where it's directed at the people and the particular devices that those people use. So, you know, making sites accessible for screen readers, for people who use screen readers. The other way of looking at accessibility is this idea of universality, where you're not doing it for any particular device. You're trying to reach as many devices as possible and as many people as possible, usually by following the standards. And this is what I want to look at, the idea of universality. Now, let me clarify that universality does not mean that everybody gets the same experience, that everybody, no matter what their device or browser, goes to a website or a web application and they all have the same experience. That's not the idea. I don't think that really follows the spirit of the web anyway. I'm talking more about a site that can adapt to the needs of the people using any particular device. So universality is the goal, and achieving that goal is generally pretty easy when you follow the principle of progressive enhancement. Is everybody here familiar with the principle of progressive enhancement? Great, excellent. The term itself was actually coined here at South by Southwest a couple of years ago by Steve Champion, Nick Fink did a panel here. It's normally applied, I guess, to CSS more than anything. For me, it defines my workflow for everything, really. So progressive enhancement is at the heart of what I do with just about everything. I'll quickly run through how progressive enhancement works. The idea is pretty simple, that you begin with your content. Content is king, right? I know, it's a cliche, but it's true. So you begin with your content, and you decide how to structure it. I'm thinking of semantic structure here. So you're deciding, what does this mean? What's the best element to describe this particular bit of text? What's the best element to describe that bit of text? Is this a heading? Is this a paragraph? All that kind of stuff. Now, at this stage, you're not even thinking about how should this look or how should this behave. You're purely thinking about what does this mean. So you begin with your content, then you add your structure. And only then do you add the presentation. You start to think, okay, I want this to look a certain way, so I start applying my styles. So CSS, at this stage, how should it look? And then is the time to start thinking about behavior. How should this work? the idea is that because you've applied these layers one on top of the other, if you were to strip any of those layers away, that would be okay because you'd still be able to get your content no matter what. The content was always there regardless of presentation, regardless of behavior. So that's the theory of progressive enhancement. And in practice, we have technologies for each step of that process. So when we come to structure our content, we have HTML. That's what it's for semantically marking up your content. And then for the presentation, we have CSS. And for behavior, we have, on the web, JavaScript is pretty much the only option. So JavaScript plus the document object model, and of late, Ajax. Ajax is a way of adding the behavior to your site. Here's the problem. A lot of the Ajax applications out there are built like this. The Ajax comes first. It's before you even get to the content, people are just thinking about how should this behave. It's the interaction coming before the actual content. I see this as a problem because now immediately Ajax is a requirement to get to any of those other layers. You can't even get to the content unless you have Ajax. So you're pretty much throwing out the idea of progressive enhancement and saying to go any further, you must have Ajax. I don't think this works too well. I better define what I mean by Ajax because it is a term that's getting a bit muddied. Ajax isn't those flashy effects and the yellow fades and things moving about. Ajax specifically is about communication with the server. It's the asynchronous part of Ajax that really makes it cool, frankly. The fact that you can update part of the page with information from the server without refreshing the whole page. That's not a very sexy definition, I know, but I think it's the most accurate. So it's nothing to do with moving things around. It's nothing to do with fading things in and out. It really is that communication with the server and the fact that you can retrieve information from the server without refreshing the whole page. So just want to get that out of the way, what I mean by Ajax. So the traditional web, the web that we all loved, web that's been around since Tim Berners-Lee invented it, is a pretty typical model of the thin client. Now, with the thin client on the web, what we have is our browser and our server. And on the server, that's where we're storing our data, and that's where we're storing our information. So that's what servers are good at. Also, that's where we're processing information and processing data. So the business logic of our applications, the business logic of our websites. This is where all the smart stuff gets done generally, is on the server, in some server-side programming language, you know, PHP, Java, Perl, whatever. The browser is simply there to display the information, the data, the content to the user. This is the traditional web. This is a classic example of the thin client. All the hard work going on in the server, the browser's just displaying it. Now, when you throw Ajax into the mix, you get the rich client, what looks like a rich client. So Ajax, I kind of imagine it sitting between the browser and the server. It doesn't really, you know, it's a browser technology. It's a JavaScript object, really, the XML HTTP request. But this is the way I like to conceptualize it, is that you've got the browser and the server, and sitting in between it, you've got Ajax. So Ajax can take that information from the server, pass it along to the browser, and update part of the document currently loaded into the browser. Now, with this model, you still have the server storing the information, and you still have the browser displaying the information. And here's the danger, that when Ajax enters the mix, it's really tempting to get the browser doing the processing, that the browser starts doing all the heavy lifting. And this is how you end up with the problem of Ajax being a requirement for a site, because now you're saying you can't even use this site unless you have Ajax, because Ajax and JavaScript and all this clever browser programming stuff is what's required to do any kind of processing. A rich client, essentially. The client now, the browser, is more powerful than the server. And I don't think that's where the strength of Ajax lies at all. I have what I hope is a solution for this problem, and I call it Hijax, because if I've learned anything from Jesse James Garrett, it's that having a snappy little buzzword will get you everywhere in life. So this is my contribution to the buzzword cloud. Hijax. Yes. Hijax. Hijax is a pretty simple idea. You don't have to use the word. It's a silly word, but it's more the idea that I want to get across. Let me explain what Hijax is. Hijax is simply progressive enhancement, but applied to Ajax. So you begin with your content, you begin with your structure, then you got your presentation, and finally you add Ajax. It really is as simple as that. It sounds pretty simple. There are challenges thrown up by this, but the great thing about Hijax is what it results in is what I'd like to call the deceptively rich client. So you've got your browser, you've got your server. This is the traditional model of interaction on the web. In the browser, you've got links, maybe with query strings that contain information, and you've got forms that the user fills in. So this is how information gets sent to the server generally. Clicking on a link, filling in a form. It's been that way for as long as the web has existed. That's pretty much the way that we send information to the server. So we click on a link or we fill in a form and that information gets sent to the server. Now the server sends back a whole page to the browser. That's the web. That's the way the web works. Though generally it's not like on the server there's full pages of, you know, HTML sitting there waiting to get served up. Usually what you have is a more modular approach, right? So you have scripts on the server that are in charge of putting together the header, the nav, you know, a shopping cart or whatever. And they all get put together, baked into one page on the server, and then served up as a page, right? I think this is pretty much the way that most websites are built these days. There's some kind of processing going on that stuff is put together on the fly rather than sitting there ready-made waiting to go. Now, we introduce Ajax into the mix. So again, the browser's got links, the browser's got forms. We click on the links, we fill in the forms. Now, instead of that information going all the way back to the server, this time what we do is we intercept those links. We intercept those forms. It's almost as if we hijack them. Huh? See what I did there? So we intercept those links, intercept those forms, take that information and say, okay, no, don't send it all the way back to the server. Instead, just send it to the Ajax object, to XML HTTP request, which, like I said, I like to think is kind of sitting halfway between the browser and the server. So we send it along to the Ajax object sitting there right in the middle. It then passes it along to the server. Now the server takes that information from the XML HTTP request object, and in this case, instead of baking together a whole page of, you know, the header, the nav, and the footer and all that stuff, we say, no, this time, actually, because we're only updating part of the page, just give me that one little bit. I just need, you know, search results, or I just need to update a shopping cart or some part of the page. And then that gets sent back to the browser and you get part of the page updating. So I like to call this the deceptively rich client, because the reason is we're still using the server for storing, obviously, but we're still using it for processing. And the browser is still just displaying the information. But to the user now, it appears to be processing. It appears to be doing lots of powerful interactions because we're just updating part of the page. Actually, the browser isn't doing anything clever at all. All the heavy lifting, all the business logic is still happening on the server. But to the user, they can't tell. It looks like, wow, this is a really rich interface. Everything is happening in my browser. Hence the deceptively rich client. So if you think about it, in this case, I'm using Ajax, the XML HTTP request object, as a dumb waiter. All it's doing is passing information backwards and forwards. The browser gives it the order, it sends it to the server, comes back. It's not doing anything clever at all. And I think that's the way to do it. It's almost like Unix pipes doing just one thing really well rather than trying to get it to do too much clever stuff. So if you do this, if you have the deceptively rich client, then if you were to take Ajax out of the equation, that would be okay. Because the links and the forms would still work in the old-fashioned way. Because you built it with progressive enhancement, you could strip away that Ajax layer and you'd be able to degrade gracefully to the original application that used, you know, old-fashioned, unsexy links and forms. Now, there is a little bit of a paradox in what I'm saying here. Because on the one hand, I'm saying, yeah, to build an Ajax application, you start by building a regular old-fashioned web page. You just start by having links and forms. You don't even think about Ajax. On the other hand, that server-side architecture is kind of vital. You do need to have this modular approach on the server side where things are baked together rather than having whole pages sitting ready to go. So I think this paradox can be resolved by following these two simple rules. One is that you plan for Ajax from the start. So in other words, when you're thinking about, you know, your server-side architecture, have it in mind that it should be as modular as possible, just in case you might want to use Ajax in the future. So you plan for Ajax from the start, but you don't implement Ajax until the end. That's the crucial part. And as long as you follow those rules, I think the paradox sort of resolves and you get the best of both worlds. Things to watch out for, if you know, theoretically, so you should be thinking purely semantically to begin with, then you can think about presentation and finally about behavior. If you find yourself doing things like this, you need to catch yourself. If you find yourself saying, href equals JavaScript, right? The JavaScript pseudo protocol. Beware. Because clearly, if you're thinking semantically about a web page and you have an href value that has the JavaScript pseudo protocol, then you're not really thinking semantically, you're thinking about behavior at that stage. Also, I just hate the JavaScript pseudo protocol. But what's a pseudo protocol anyway? I mean, protocols are things like HTTP and FTP. They send information over the network. You can't send information over the network with JavaScript. Sorry. So if you catch yourself doing this, watch out. You're jumping the gun. You're thinking about behavior too early. Also, if you find yourself doing this, and this is something you see a lot if you view source in Ajax applications, ahref equals octothorpe. And then you start having event handlers right there in the markup. This won't degrade. You're not really applying progressive enhancement. So watch out for this kind of thing. So here's the pattern I want you to think about. As I said, think about Ajax from the start, but don't implement it until the very end. You're on a page, or your user is on a page, and there's a link, and they click that link. Now, exactly the same page comes back, but only part of it has changed. Or alternatively, here's the other pattern. You're on a page, there's a form. You fill in that form, and exactly the same page comes back, and only part of it has changed. So some examples would be when you're rating things, right? Think like Amazon, those star ratings, a really small, discrete part of the page. You could have a really, really, really long page with 10 products on it, and you've got those 5 stars, and you can click 1 to 5. Now, you click those stars. If the whole page was to come back and the only thing that changed was just to say, yep, okay, 4 stars, got it. That's really frustrating. That's the perfect opportunity to use Hijax or to use Ajax because you just want to update that really discrete part of the page. So rating, you know, I think this is actually a really, really, really good use of Ajax. I know when most people think about Ajax, they're thinking about Google Maps and they're thinking about Gmail and these big, big, sexy applications. But for me, it's the small stuff. It's the small stuff that ease the path, that make things just that bit more usable, that really, really add value to your sites. So ratings, that's a good place to do it. Registering. Okay. A particular bugbear. You're on a site. There's a little form, you know, choose a username, choose a password. You click submit. Off it goes to the server. The whole page comes back just to give you the same page and say, sorry, that username is already taken. Right? And if it's Yahoo or Hotmail, then you repeat this a couple of thousand times. Now, I saw this happen with the whole Flickr Yahoo merging of identities thing, kerfuffle a while back. Paul in my office didn't have a Yahoo account, so he had to try and choose one. And he was there for a long time inputting usernames. At one stage, he mashed his keyboard randomly and it still came back and said, sorry, that username is already taken. So that would be a really good opportunity to just update that one part of the page so that the pattern really holds true. Comments, getting sort of to bigger areas of the page now, but I think it still works in this situation. Think about a blog post. You've got the header, the navigation, probably a sidebar, the blog post itself, all the previous comments, and then a form where you fill in your comment. Now you fill in that form, you click submit, and what you get back? The whole page. The header, the sidebar, the navigation, the same blog post, all those comments again. And the only thing that's changed is that your comment has been added to the page. So there I think that the pattern still holds true, and that would be a good place to use Ajax and update just that one part of the page. Shopping carts. I think I'm really surprised that Ajax hasn't been used more in e-commerce applications, especially if you think you got like 10 products on a page and you click that add to cart button, whether it's a link or a form, probably should be a form, and it brings back the whole page. And the only thing that's changed is over in the sidebar, there's your shopping cart and you've added that one product to the form. So again, to shopping cart, that pattern holds true. You're clicking a link or you're filling in a form, you're getting back the exact same page and just one discrete area of that page has changed. So it's a very simple pattern, but you will see it over and over and over again once you start to look for it. So you kind of develop a smell for this. You start to sniff out these patterns and think, oh, you know, this might be a good place to use Ajax. So you stick with this And what you end up with, what Dan Cederholm coined this term bulletproof to describe, sort of catering for those edge case scenarios by making sure that you've got, you know, really solid sort of approach. It's basically because of progressive enhancement, because you can strip away those layers, because you can deal with the 5-10% who don't have the typical browser, who don't have the typical platform you're expecting. It is also coincidentally the name of a new book I've just written, Bulletproof Ajax, and we do have copies of that book, and we will be giving them away to people who ask the best questions. But for now, you know Kung Fu. So well done. And let's hear from Derek, who's got the really hard job.
I don't think I have the hard job, actually. I think I've got it easy because Jeremy's just laid a really great foundation for a lot of the things that I want to talk about. The stance that I want to take on accessibility is a little bit different than what Jeremy was talking about. He was talking about accessibility as being universality, or that at least being one component of it. I believe in that, and I think that's an important goal. But I'm also very, very much rooted in the practical nature of web development, and I have a lot of clients where they don't have the money or the time to do both, to make something that is, a Hijax type application where you have it work in the old-fashioned model and you have it work in with Ajax as well. And so, in a lot of those cases, my goal is really to focus on accessibility as part of user experience for people with disabilities and ensuring that application is built in such a way that it does have compatibility with screen readers, and it does work with voice recognition software and screen magnification software, and that it's as easy to use as possible for people with cognitive disabilities. So when I look at this whole the accessibility, dare I say, camp one versus camp two, I think that it's really just, you know, like we should all just be camping together in the first place, and let's just kind of balance this out, because a lot of what we do is a bit of a balancing act. And that's why I like the idea of accessibility as being about a bit of feng shui, because feng shui is all about harmony and balance and finding ways of kind of creating environments where things can peacefully coexist. That's, wow. Did anybody write that down? That's kind of the stance that I take on it, and what I'm hoping to share with you a little bit here today. Now, I thought of this because I thought we used feng shui in the title of the session, so I better work some of that in here. So I've worked some of that in here. Feng shui, literally translated, means wind and water, and it was actually kind of interesting reading it, because the wind is, you know, they talk about wind as being full of energy and very transformative. And they talk about water as being something that actually stores energy and is quite stable. And I thought that's an interesting way to approach what we're doing here. We want to have a lot of energy and a lot of vitality and interactiveness in our applications, but we also want to have that core stability that gives everybody what they need. So wind and water to me was kind of like this, you know, this utopia, this peace and harmony type metaphor. And then I really thought, well, we can extend that, and we've seen this in a lot of places. Wind and water can really be quite destructive and has a lot of destructive power in it. When you look at some of these storms that are out there in nature that just absolutely obliterate places, that's kind of the feeling that I get with a lot of Ajax applications now. Take those same core elements, wind and water, and they can actually be used in such a way that is quite destructive. So let's look at not being destructive. Briefly talk about Ajax and scripting and accessibility and how this all fits together and how it ties together with what Jeremy just said. So in 1999, accessible scripting meant that your site works both with and without JavaScript. And basically what that meant was we use JavaScript in such a way that we have, say, a no script tag that will provide some other alternate functionality. That was one of the original ways of making your site work with scripting on and off. Over time, that progressed so that we got smart and we did other things where we ensured that if JavaScript was off, our links still worked. When we were generating drop-down menus, we we didn't generate the whole menu with JavaScript. We just generated the second level flyout menus, and we had the top level of the menu still just function as a regular old link. These were some of the things that we did in trying to ensure that we were scripting in an accessible way. And that, in for the most part, comes from WCAG 1.0. Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, and the landscape in 1999 was such that this is what we were told: ensure that your pages work with scripting on or off. And that was going to deal with a lot of different scenarios. Screen readers at the time didn't really support JavaScript. They were much simpler than they are now. So what we started to see and I first started really noticing this in 2004 and 2005 was that accessible scripting actually meant something completely different. And here's one of the examples why. This is a quick screenshot from a site that we built, not our design, that we built in 2005. And it uses some simple drop-down menus, JavaScript-based drop-down menus. You mouse over the link, and in this case, it even worked with the keyboard. When you put, when that top-level link receives focus, the second-level menu shows. And we started doing some testing, and this was using an old, Dreamweaver script, the way Dreamweaver generates is its drop-down menus. So, pretty typical, the types of things that you would see, in a lot of government shops where people are using Dreamweaver, and a lot of people still use it. So this was partly a menu that was generated from that. And then I took, some other menus like Brother Cake's, ultimate drop-down menu, which is really heavily scripted, but really deals well with progressive enhancement and graceful degradation and fallbacks. And it uses a strategy where we have a link as the top level menu. And when the page loads, an on click is dynamically attached to that link so that the on click behavior will display the next level of the menu or however it ended up working. And we started doing some testing with screen readers on this. And in this particular case, when the screen reader got to the about link that was going to display the second level menu, it actually told the screen reader user on click. So there was an audio cue that an on click was available. In the other examples that we were looking at, the on click was not announced. And I started trying to do experiments and figure out why. So what it turns out happens is that the screen readers at this time is like JAWS 5 and 5.5 and Window Eyes maybe version 4. What they did was they were looking for inline hard-coded on clicks that were put in there by the Dreamweaver code. And so what was happening was when we created this dynamic menu that attached the on click and it was not listed in line, it was actually added after the fact, the screen readers were not recognizing that. And I thought, this is ridiculous. Because we are trying to do the right thing. We're trying to code in the right way and use progressive enhancement. And yet the screen readers aren't understanding that. We're doing the right thing. And they're not. So I didn't really like that. And this is when all these red flags started going up in my head. This just can't be right. Now the other side of this is that the on click behavior that's exposed to a screen reader user goes something like this. On click is announced. And there, the screen reader user is expected to know, instead of hitting enter, that they're supposed to hit control enter. And that activates the on click. Then the screen reader tells them that the page changed at line 54. At which point the screen reader user hits the J key for jump, and they enter the line 54, and then they hit enter, which then kind of takes the focus to the spot on the page where the page changed. So clearly everybody that uses a screen reader knows how to do this. And it's been a very, very successful behavior. this is one of my very first real frustrating moments with a screen reader was trying to get past this. Why is it not understanding the on click? So then in 2006, Jeremy started talking about hijacks. I thought, fantastic. This is great. But one of the things, and Jeremy and I talk about this all the time, hijacks, and I'm going to show you an example here of an actual real hijacks is not just this theoretical concept. It's actually happening in the wild. And a little while ago, I looked at a site from Canada, Chapters.ca. It's our online bookstore. similar to Amazon, but still doesn't even have nearly the market share, I think, that Amazon.ca has. But these guys are kind of getting it. And this is a new enhanced version of their site. I thought it was really cool. They're actually, when you get to a product page where you're looking at an actual book, they're doing all kinds of things that are kind of progressive in terms of conceptually anyway. They're allowing people to tag their products. They're trying to help people find things after the fact. They're really jumping on board with that, which I think is great. And so I saw what they were doing here, and they've got this little link that says, "What is this?" which I think is great, because you know, when you're introducing something new, a new feature, you need to help people understand what it is. So they use this hijacks approach where when you click on the link and you have JavaScript on, it goes and does some fancy magic with Ajax and brings this content back and puts it in the page. So it's like a little bit of helper content. So I thought, okay, well, what happens if JavaScript is off? And I totally didn't expect this. But with JavaScript off, it just goes and loads another page that tells people what is Ajax. And I thought, brilliant. Great. Now, let's look at this, though, because why did they use Ajax for this in the first place? This is, if you take a look at the screenshot here, we've got the "What is this" link. There's this extra little bit of content that really we probably didn't even need to use Ajax for in the first place. I'm glad that they hijacked it, and I'm glad that they used that approach. But can we do something more simple that's going to make this work? And here's one of the issues. If we pop up some new content on a page, well, what happens to a screen reader user that doesn't actually know that anything has popped up on the page? We used to use pop-up, little tiny pop-up windows for this, right? How many people have done a pop-up window before? Don't be afraid. Put your hands up. Almost like at least 50% of people in here have done that. Well, here's the thing with a pop-up window, and it's almost blasphemy to say this, but what if the fact that a pop-up window, a little tiny pop-up window that only contains this new little bit of content and not the whole wrapper page, like everything else that goes around it, it's only containing the relevant content. What if that little tiny pop-up window is actually more accessible than this strategy, because the screen reader here doesn't get the update? They don't know what's happening. They don't know where to go next. They've just had this thing magically appear and no new window was announced, because that's not a window, right? That's something that we've done with JavaScript and CSS. So what if that's actually the case? Are we actually making things worse? And this is one of the things that we really have to start asking this question. Are we making it worse by doing this, because it is doing something that's so different from the conventional web? So how do we get around that? And in this case, I think I wouldn't even use Ajax for this. They may have their own reasons why, but this is helper content. It's extra content that's related to one specific area of the page. And what I would do in this particular case is all that, what is this, the extra helper content, I would just embed that in the page, maybe somewhere down at the bottom. It can be in a help section for that page. But what I would do is when that page loads, I would hide it, use the CSS to hide it, and then use the CSS and the JavaScript to bring it back at this stage. So what we would, and then of course the critical component to this is this, what is this link? If that extra helper content is already in the page, what should the href be for that, what is this? Take it to a named anchor in the page, or to some fragment identifier, or to an ID. A much simpler strategy that doesn't use Ajax, that just already has that helper content there in the page. So that's kind of a critical component. And the nice thing is with using a real href, maybe instead of totally hijacking that link, we should actually just let it go. Because if we hop to a named anchor in the page, we can potentially go right there with the screen reader and they'll continue reading from that spot. Andy. Well, they've chosen to do that, though. That's the thing, right? It's helper content. So they've chosen to do that. Yes. Yes. Potentially. And here's another solution to that. The question was, doesn't that taking them to another part of the page potentially disorient them and take them away from what their actual goal is? And part of my response to that is yes, potentially possible, but they've chosen to do that. So one of the ways around that is to take that close link, and style it appropriately so that it's at the end of the helper content. And when you click the close link, where should they go? Back to where they were. So there are ways around it, and that may not be the perfect solution, right? It may not be the perfect solution, but at its core, that is fundamentally what we're doing. And that kind of builds on what Jeremy's talking about in terms of hijacking links and forms. Let's use the default behaviors that exist to our advantage rather than doing on clicks and adding in all these on clicks and things that don't actually work as real links. Let's create linear pathways through the page if we can, if such a linear pathway exists. So what we're really talking about, and this has always been the case, we've talked about HTML being our core of content and CSS being our core for presentation and JavaScript being our behavior. But there are core behaviors that are built into HTML that we need to utilize and allow those things to do some of the hard work for us. So things like named anchors within pages, creating a linear path through the page if we can. This is an example that I've shown before, and I'll just explain it very quickly. If this is based on testing as well, it's not just pure theoretical work. One of the things that we always see in scripting and in any web development is we have to deal with error messages, in particular with forms, things like your username. So in this particular case, I've got a form field with an advisory type message saying the username must not contain spaces, right? That's there as information beforehand to help the user understand what they are required to fill in or what some of the parameters are for that field. One of the ways that this would be coded a long time ago would be to put this in three table cells. And even if you had username as a label, if you had your label and then your table cell that had your text box and then another table cell beside that that has your must contain only spaces, a screen reader user may never get to that, right? Because it's not actually part of the form. It's just this extra advisory text. So what we start to do is find creative ways of making this information like must not contain spaces. Well, that must not contain spaces is actually information about the field. So it should be part of the label that is associated with that field. So what we do come up with is code structures like label as part of the label for username field, we include something that's potentially emphasized. And emphasized because we're actually emphasizing that particular phrase about that field. That makes sense? We just use some fancy CSS to push that must not contain spaces over to the side. The nice thing is that we can now use that structure and change it so that when we have an error occur, and I'm not a visual designer, but I still think that this is reasonably okay. If we end up with an error, instead of using the emphasis tag or an EM element to specify the advisory information, we're now in an error situation. Let's put that error into a strong tag because now that it's an error, we want to strongly emphasize that. Make sense? Here's the really, really cool thing, and this is what gives me goosebumps. In testing this, if we use this strategy, because the text is part of the label, even though visually it doesn't look like it's part of the label, a screen reader gets that update. There's been a lot of talk about screen readers, and I say it too, screen readers not being compatible with JavaScript. But this is really exciting because screen readers do get this. If we use JavaScript or Ajax or whatever it is, to update the contents of a label, that is exposed quite well to a screen reader. There are some caveats. One of the problems with this is that in order for it to get the updated label, you have to leave that field and go back to it, right? Which is a bit of a problem, but that's one that we can solve. And we won't go into all the details, but we can do things like change the status bar in the browser. People know what a status bar is. So for an application, that's one of the first keystrokes that they know is what to do to check the status. We can change the title of the page to say that an error occurred in such and such a place. We can change the legend text that goes in the field set that this is part of. There's a lot of different things that we can do. One of the experiments that we've done with this is to add a label to the submit button that tells them that there is a problem somewhere in the form and that they can go back and review it. It's not perfect. We haven't gone to the point where we've done this for every possible combination permutation, but this kind of thing does work. I'm gonna skip over that because it's frustrating. We'll do it. This is a screen reader demo of using JavaScript to update part of a page in a way that I thought would never work. This isn't supposed to work, right? This is one of the things that I'm thinking.
Title is populate table with inner HTML dash Microsoft Internet Explorer. Heading level 4 available meetings. Heading level 4 available meetings. Heading level 4 available meetings. Running the top. Heading level 4 available meetings.
That's just me goofing around.
Grabbing the top. Populate meetings button. Space. Populate meetings button. Blank. Heading level 4 available meetings April 11th, 2006. Blank. Table with 4 columns and 5 rows. Blank. Visited link graphic plus. 8:00-9:30 graphic audio.
I'm going to go past that because it just basically goes through and reads it all. But this was using a method that was not supposed to work. So now you know I got frustrated with it. One of the things that is happening in scripting right now in heavily scripted applications that are using Ajax or just scripting and screen readers is that we don't have enough test cases. And so one of the things that we're working on is trying to figure out, well, this wasn't supposed to work. Why did it? And so there is a lot of work that needs to be done. I don't want to paint a really rosy picture and say that we can do anything we want to. But at the same time, there are some test cases that we need to sort through first to understand why it is that worked. Maybe it worked because it was, dare I say, in a table. Maybe something about that, the fact that it was a table has some effect on the way that the screen readers are processing it. We don't have a whole lot of time left. I want to go through a couple of quick things and then we're going to go to questions for everybody. I guess one of the main points that we looked at with that hijacks example is the idea of where next. If you have an application, a complicated application, if you click on some button or some link to activate something and you're using Ajax or scripting to populate another part of the page, if it makes sense, we should take people there. And so this is where we start using things like href equals Octothorpe. Next stop. We start using structures like this to take people to the next spot in the page that makes sense. And sometimes we need to use a tab index of -1. I won't get into the details of that, but we can programmatically focus on things that have a tab index of -1, even if they're not normally focusable. So we do have a means to lead people around the page. This can actually work. Another possibility is using a semantic functional state. And what I mean by that is using the disabled and read-only properties of a form field to your advantage when you're scripting. These things are completely scriptable. So we had this application where we wanted people to be able to go through and edit a lot of things in the page. And what we did was we started scripting to disable form fields so that they didn't appear in the tab flow. Disabled form fields are not focusable when you're using the keyboard. So that reduces a lot of the auditory noise that would come from going to all these things that aren't even editable or activatable. Same thing with the read-only. So starting to use some of these things in your scripting because they have meaning and they're there for us to use. I like to call that sort of semantic interaction, right? We're not just talking about semantics in terms of headings and paragraphs and list items and block quotes. We want to talk about semantic interaction, things that actually make sense and are used for the right reason. I'm going to skip over emulation because we could spend a whole day on that. But basically, what it means is that the future of a lot of this stuff and compatibility with screen readers is going to an emulation type thing where we say this component of the page, or these components of the page are related to a specific form field so that the screen reader can actually understand that message that you just put on the screen is something to do with that particular form field, or that this big block of this div up here that's collecting all the errors is actually something to do with errors. And that when it pops up in the page, we might give that a role of alert. So we might say that this should function the same way as an alert in that it tells the screen reader user that something has just happened up there and it draws attention to it. Right now, a lot of what we're doing is kind of making things up as we go. This is one of the things that the W3C and IBM and Mozilla are working on to have scripting actually talk directly to screen readers through the accessibility API. That's really hardcore geeky stuff that I don't even understand all of it yet. That sounded like I might understand it all at some point, but it's quite possible that I won't. It's really hardcore geeky stuff that we're definitely not going to get into. One of the things that I guess I want to leave you with is that it's always an option to choose not to use Ajax. If there's a simpler solution available, great. If not, maybe Ajax is fine. And maybe what we need to do is start considering that an alternative might be quite reasonable, or allowing people to set a preference that says, and I wouldn't word it this way, turn Ajax off, but we might do something that we enable a preference that says enable page refreshes so that it's easier and more compatible to use. And that the Hijax approach really allows us to do that. My last slide is, I heard that Jeremy and Andy had a saying in their panel, how to bluff your way through Web 2.0. And it was that accessibility just ain't exciting. But I believe that accessibility is just as sexy as anything else going. So, speaking of sexy, I think we've got about 10 or 12 minutes, I think. So why don't we, there's microphones for questions. There's microphone for questions, and we'll be happy to answer.
My question is regarding Drupal or other similar type tools where you can download packages and add modules and that sort of thing, and how that sort of fits into the progressive enhancement way of building sites, because it seems like there could be a tendency to focus on the structure and presentation before we even start putting any content up in there. And so maybe just talk a little bit about that with respect to progressive enhancement, as well as how you can incorporate the Hijax method you're talking about.
Yeah, so this kind of goes to the idea I was talking about of building things in a modular way on the server so that you can then later make the decision to perhaps use Ajax to update part of the page after you've already got the pages working fine without Ajax. The CMS you use is obviously going to be a big factor in that. The server-side programming language you use, how modular that is. I think it's just going to change on a case-by-case basis. And it's probably something you should have in mind when you're deciding what CMS to use. If your CMS doesn't allow you to do this, then get a new CMS. It's the decisions. It's something to bear in mind way, 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 way back in the decision-making process of deciding what to use or whether to use a CMS, whether to hand roll it.
And one thing on that, I know there are some people that are working on Drupal stuff where it's kind of a standards compliant theming mechanism for it. So I know that some of the stuff is possible, but I don't know. I haven't implemented Drupal anywhere, but it's definitely something to consider at the beginning, whether you can get themes that support web standards in that approach or not. And how, do you have the ability to do anything with the scripting that's done in the page, or is it all hard coded in the head or off in external files? So, but there are theming. I know that people are working on theming for it. Glenda. Oh, no.
No, Kenneth. I'm not going to ask them to remove that slide. I think it's sexy. So I'm inspired and hopeful about rich Good. Internet applications being accessible. But South by Southwest only scrapes the surface. So if I wanted to mind meld with you for hours, what opportunities would I have?
Well... Yeah. Intimate and interactive.
In a room.
This is a...
Did y'all leave?
You know what? You're probably best to go off to the nobility booth in the trade show, because there is... this is so cheesy. I can't believe I'm doing this. Glenda, you totally set us up. Nobility in the booth. There's a conference called Access U in May that's here in Austin. A two-day conference. I'm also doing a shameless plug, doing a full-day workshop the day before that is all about, it goes in, like, it's a full day of some of the stuff that I did in 15 minutes up here. So, there are other opportunities always, especially for you, Glenda.
Well, I kind of have the same question in that as I work to build my business and I'm working hand in hand with my engineers, how do I make sure that they're as up to date as I want them to be and as affluent as you two may be on this, all of this cutting edge work?
Well, things are changing in sort of the JavaScript world generally. Things are getting more savvy. A few years ago, it was really hard to find good JavaScript resources. Everything was old, and it was old school style scripting. Nobody was thinking about this stuff. In the last few years, it's incredible. I mean, just the fact that you have people like Derek, and you have people like James Edwards and Christian Heilman. Now, where the skill sets are JavaScript and accessibility, and there's a Venn diagram of JavaScript and accessibility coming together. Now, just a few years ago, those two circles would have been miles apart. The mere idea that the people who do JavaScript were even thinking about accessibility is crazy. So I'm actually pretty hopeful that there are good resources out there now. There certainly weren't. And a lot of people have sort of frozen perceptions of JavaScript, and they've written it off as being inaccessible, and all the resources are rubbish and all this kind of stuff. But that perception was true in 99, 2000, and it's changing now. The problem is that Google never forgets, right? So you Google something and you get an outdated resource that's just inaccurate. Or
right. Would you say that your book is one of those resources?
Yeah, okay.
I would say his book is one of those resources. And not, I mean, this one is great too, but the DOM scripting book that Jeremy wrote before this is fantastic for that as well, especially for beginners.
Right, for beginners. And yeah. I ask because I want to have a certain awareness in order to speak with my engineers and know that I'm kind of leading them, or that I have a general awareness so that, I don't know, I can work with them as best as I can. So is your book accessible for someone like me?
Yeah, it's a dummy's guide, sort of. It's pretty basic.
He didn't mean that.
No offense.
That was pretty.
That was bad. No, it's specifically aimed not at programmers, because there's lots and lots of books aimed for programmers, like coming, say, from, especially now that Ajax is big and sexy. You got people from the server side world, you know, who used to using Java and other proper programming languages, now having to learn JavaScript. And there's plenty of resources out there for them. But I'm aiming for the people from the other end who are more designers, more front-end people,
right,
or project managers or whatever, who need to have some understanding or get a head around this without, you know, all the jargon and all the stuff. So I'll give you your payment in the corridor later for setting that up. That's great.
An independent observer product manager halfway through an ETL. You tried.
Stop.
I have a question about the what's this link that you guys were talking about with the pop-up.
Yeah.
The solution that you described about using the anchor, using the Hijax approach would hijack the link click and make it appear. But now for an accessibility for a screen reader that might have JavaScript turned on, would that still hijack that, and would that be then inaccessible to that user?
Yeah, and that was kind of exactly the point that I was trying to make. So apparently I didn't explain it very well, but ultimately that's exactly it. We deal with a situation where 99 times out of 100, screen reader users are using a JavaScript enabled browser and scripting is on. So that's part of what this balancing act is about, is trying to find a way to I was just going to say something that I can't say about Cameron and Diaz. Trying to find a way to actually make it, you know, make it so that it is accessible, so that when that Hijax approach does pop up and appear, that we actually use JavaScript to our advantage to put the focus in the right spot so that a screen reader can continue reading from there, and it does make sense.
The approach that's looking pretty promising is the tab index minus one approach. Jez Lemon has been doing a lot of cool research on that. That's looking promising. It basically comes down to the fact that screen readers have biases towards things like forms and links because those are focusable. So if we can give things like divs that same sort of bias and expose them, then that will help. It still feels hackish, but all we've got is hacks now because we're dealing with a hacky situation.
Yeah. Is that worthy of a book?
No, I'm not going to plug a book again. I'm going to plug Jez Lemon. Go to juicystudios.com. Yeah, he's doing great work.
I think we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left, so we'll try to get through all the questions that we have here.
So there are lots of great patterns that we as developers can use to make our Ajax applications more accessible, but where are the screen readers falling short? What can they do to improve that, and why are they so damn slow?
Great question.
Yeah, we're working on this right now with some of them, or trying to, through the Web Standards Project, the Accessibility Task Force. We've tried to open the dialogue, and we're trying to work on that. But one of the biggest things, as you saw with that one example that I showed, with the actual screen reader clip, is that that wasn't supposed to work, but it did. And so now one of the big things that we're taking on with the Accessibility Task Force is trying to write test cases so that we can see where the shortfalls are. A lot of the screen reader manufacturers right now are starting to do this, a lot of research into the rich internet applications to make things work. Like the stuff that I was talking about, emulation, WindowEyes has some preliminary support for that. They are working on that with their betas right now and in some of their live real stable versions. So it is happening. It's slow because they're not cutting edge. I mean, the other thing is that they also have to have backwards compatibility with all the other crap sites that are out there that don't use, you know, real like modern day approaches to web development because they were built in 2000 or 2001 and they just don't pass muster with our current standards. So.
Is there one thing that your dream, this one feature that would be added to screen readers?
I can't nail it down to just one. There's too many things.
Yeah. Essentially, we're facing the innovator's dilemma where our knowledge has advanced, the browsers have advanced, but the screen readers are further back, and we're having to hack our way around that. The future, it'll all be sorted out when we've got jetpacks and flying cars, but we have to find solutions that work today with screen readers today, and that's where the frustration comes. Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah, I have a question about, this is more of a question for Jeremy. It's about when you said it's a better idea to not use the JavaScript pseudo protocol in the onclicks. I think a lot of people use that is that we don't really know the alternative. What would be a good alternative to doing that?
Well, that you use progressive randomness. When you come to put an A element into your page, which is an anchor element, the href attribute is hypertext reference. It points to a resource either in the same page or on the World Wide Web. And if it doesn't, you're using the wrong element. It shouldn't be a link to begin with. The only time it would be acceptable to use a JavaScript pseudo protocol or anything like that is if you were generating the link with JavaScript to begin with. But if you're thinking about a behavior at the stage of what's the hypertext reference for this A element in this HTML document, you're thinking about behavior way too early. So you think about where is this resource? Where is it pointing? Is it in this page? Is it another page on the web? And that's what you put in there. And later you hijack it, intercept it, and do your behavior. Oh, I see. Yeah, definitely observer pattern sort of thing where, you know, you're watching, you're waiting for the click to happen, that kind of thing. If you got lots and lots, I mean, I tend to just attach events to the individual links and forms, but obviously that doesn't really scale too well. What a Yahoo, for instance, do when they got a really big, heavy page like the Yahoo homepage, they just have something looking at the whole page, waiting for just anywhere in the page to be clicked. And then they look and say, okay, which part of the page just got clicked? And then look for the right event to do that. So it depends on the scale of it, really.
Thank you. Just before we get, I think we're almost running out, but we want to go over to John Slayton, who's with us, for a quick question in the audience.
Thanks. I think my question is actually about the semantics of links and buttons. I'm running into a lot of pages lately, and not all of them are Ajax pages, but a lot of them are, an increasing number of them are, things like Yahoo Mail on the page where you compose a message or Blogger on the page where you compose your posts. There are, I'm getting increasingly confused because there are things that are links, like changing the restyling a chunk of content in the compose window, if I can actually get into the compose window. And then there are other things that are buttons, like publish, or no, publish is a link. Save is a button.
Yeah.
And because the screen reader basically allows me to jump through the page according to what element, whether it's a link or a button and so on, if I'm going through links, I don't hear the buttons. If I'm going through the buttons, I don't hear the links. And I lose the ability to figure out how to control what I'm doing. And the question is, why is that happening? Because of people simply not thinking about it, or is there some semantic thing going on there that I haven't gotten my mind around yet?
I would just say that I think it is because people aren't thinking about it. In the sense that, again, when you're first coming up with the page and deciding semantically, you're just thinking about structure. What is this? What is it? And there are not rules, but there are definitely guidelines to decide when to use a form and when to use links, when something should be get, when something should be post. And these were formulated many, many years ago. This is nothing new. But people don't tend to think about this stuff anymore, and they really should. I mean, there's loads of problems crop up because people use links when they should be using form buttons. For instance, in 37 Signals Basecamp, they had a delete link on the page. Now, you should never, never have anything that will update something on the server be a link. What happened was, okay, the thing, and it's pretty safe because no search engines are going to spider that delete link because people have to be logged in. But people were logging in who had the Google toolbar accelerator that prefetches pages in the background. And of course, they're prefetching the link to delete. There should never have been a link to delete in the first place. That should have been a form. It should have been a post request because you're posting the information.
And just to follow up on that, it doesn't necessarily need to be an ugly form button. Right, you can use image-based submit buttons with proper alt text that are quite reasonable to use for forms. We have, and you can even style form buttons now as we're getting better browser support for buttons. You can style them quite nicely now, so they don't have to be ugly. You can make them look good. We want to balance this stuff together so that we meet everybody's needs. And you know, there's no reason that it couldn't be an image-based submit button.
The button element is the best kept secret in the HTML spec. Go check it out. It's pretty.
Go, Aaron.
Years ago, we couldn't do anything with it, but now we can style it to look like anything we want. So the button element is really, really useful.
Okay.
I think we've run over already.
Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you so much.
7:30 tonight, the Lava Lounge, the Great British Booze Up. Come along.
We have books for questioners.